This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Masi cho shalaknai. Thank you, all my relations, as my Gwich'in friends would say. Welcome to the Lannan Foundation in Pursuit of Cultural Freedom event this evening, and welcome to more than 150 students and teachers from United World College, St. John's College, and many local schools and colleges. And welcome to activists from many local environmental and climate justice organizations. Nearly 40,000 people had gathered in Washington, D.C. last Sunday for the climate rally. We have over 800 tonight here. Thank you all for coming. Good evening. My name is Shubhankar Banerjee. I'm deeply humbled to be sharing the stage with Dr. James Hansen this evening. It would be safe to say that the Arctic and the desert are two places where we are experiencing among the most intense impact of climate change. In New Mexico and the neighboring states, the drought, heat, and wildfires have all been very intense in recent years, and you know this. So it makes perfect sense for an event with Jim Hansen to take place in New Mexico. This is a very emotional evening for me because I have no adequate words with which to express my gratitude to Lannan Foundation for all the support they have given me over the years for fighting for the protection of the Arctic from industrial destruction. A heartfelt thank you to my friends at the Foundation, Patrick, Andy, Larry, Lori, Christy, Barbara, Mary Pat, Linda, and all the board members. I'm certainly missing my friends Patrick and Andy, who are away. With the support of Lannan Foundation, I did many events on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, including a sold-out event here at the Lensic with Peter Mathis and Sarah James, which in board member and actually the board chair of the Gwich'in Steering Committee 9 years ago. Peter and Sarah have been my mentors, and Sarah was to be with us this evening, but she is not well and could not travel. I wish her good health. While we defeated President Bush's plan again and again and again to sell the Arctic refuge to Big Oil, the crucial work of the Gwich'in Steering Committee, Alaska Wilderness League, and others go on to protect the refuge permanently, the most biodiverse conservation area in the entire Arctic. I would like to acknowledge the presence of a dear friend who has traveled from Alaska, Princess Lukai, the young and brilliant new executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. The United States has become Punxsutawney. Lately, I have been feeling like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, waking up each morning, each new drilling cycle, each new election cycle, to the same cruel realities of the climate catastrophe. And there doesn't seem to be any escape in sight. Looking into the past, the present, and thinking about where we are heading into the future, I would say the United States is the most dangerous climate criminal nation state in the world, without a rival. But the U.S. also has Dr. James Hansen. I met Jim at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in 2010 when he gave the annual public policy lecture there, in which he showed pictures of his grandchildren. It would be safe to say that the topic dearest to Jim is the connection of climate change to the future generation. As the title of his remarkable book makes clear, Storms of My Grandchildren. I will share with you a few words about youth, a transformation that has been taking place in the past few years that you may or may not have paid attention to. In June 2010, the University of Michigan published a study about empathy among the American youth. One of the researchers of the study said, quote, college kids today are about 40% lower in empathy than their counterparts of 20 or 30 years ago. Many people see the current group of college students, sometimes called Generation Me, as one of the most self-centered, narcissistic, competitive, confident, and individualistic in recent history, unquote. Fast forward to last month, the Yes magazine published an article by senior student Sachi Hopkins Hayakawa. She ended her piece with these words, wonderful piece she wrote, quote, when I receive my degree in June, I will not be thinking about graduate programs or long-term employment opportunities. I will be thinking about the fact that carbon emissions must begin to decline by 2015 if we hope to prevent a change in global temperatures of more than 2 degrees, the tipping point beyond which catastrophic climate change begins. Just 2 years from now, we risk passing that tipping point. The time to work together for climate justice is now. We cannot wait, unquote. That may be one isolated example, but something sure is changing. But why? Several reasons. The tireless Bill McKibben, with his 350.org, has brought... Yes. Young people to the climate justice movement in very, very large numbers. Where did Bill get that number 350 from? From Dr. James Hansen. It's a very good story. Hopefully Jim will tell us. If not, I'll sure to ask him during our conversation. Next, the courageous, creative, and selfless act of Tim DeChristopher, who is still serving his 2-year prison sentence, ignited the youth of his generation to get engaged with climate justice. As he said, quote, I do not want your mercy, I want you to join me, unquote. If you read Jim's book, you will know he wrote strong and inspiring words in support of Tim DeChristopher, a hero to many of us. Jim also wrote an essay published on his website, The Case for Young People and Nature. In his many lectures, he talks about youth and climate change and intergenerational climate justice. Dr. James Hansen is the director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City. His 1988 paper published in Science made for the first time the connection between anthropogenic CO2 and global warming that resulted in a front page article in the New York Times and a Senate testimony. Global warming became public for the first time. But Jim went back to research, refusing to give media interviews for 15 years, and only returned to educate lawmakers when invited by President George Bush's climate task force, only to realize later that his truth-telling was getting him in trouble. John Sununu, chief of staff of President Bush, tried to get him fired. And when NASA, he still is holding on to his job, by the way, same job as the director of the Goddard Center. And when NASA tried to silence him, his employer, he went and told the story to the New York Times. So he is a whistleblower too. Over the past years, he has written many legal declarations in support of various lawsuits and participated in numerous civil disobedience actions to stop mountaintop coal mining projects in the Appalachia and the tar sands Keystone XL pipeline. Several of these civil disobedience actions resulted in him getting arrested, including most recently outside the White House on February 14th. good that he has a job, because if he was looking for a job, he probably won't get one because he has a long list of arrest records by now. America has a long tradition of scientists as activists. Rachel Carson comes to mind. Today we have Dr. James Hansen. Please welcome Jim to our town of Santa Fe. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you. After such a long introduction, we're running behind, so I'm going to go right to my talk. But thanks very much for coming out. You know, we still have this gap between what is understood about global warming and climate change by the relevant scientific community and what's known by the people who need to know, and that is the public at large and policymakers. And it's the reason, the truth is, if you understand the science, you see that we do have an emergency. We have a crisis. But it's not obvious to the public because the climate system has tremendous inertia. It doesn't respond quickly when you apply forces to it, for example, by changing the composition of the atmosphere. Because the ocean is 2.5 miles deep, the ice sheets are a couple miles thick, so they don't change quickly. But the problem is, and because of that, although the planet is beginning to get warmer, averaged over the planet, but a lot of the warming is still in the pipeline because of that inertia. It's going to occur in the future. And the danger is that the system can pass tipping points beyond which the inertia of the system, the dynamics, can take over so that you get change will continue, which is basically out of the public's control. The good news is that it's still possible, I think, to stabilize climate at a level that preserves most of the life on the planet. But that requires that we begin to make changes very promptly. An example of tipping points is the ice sheets. Once, and the main mechanism by which the ice sheets will begin to move, lose mass rapidly, is from the warming ocean. As the ocean melts the ice shelves, the tongues of ice that come out from Antarctica and Greenland into the ocean and buttress the ice sheets, as those disappear, then the ice sheets can discharge ice to the ocean much more rapidly. And you can reach a point where the disintegration begins to happen very rapidly. And similarly, in the case of species, as we drive some of them to extinction, because there is an interdependency among them, you can reach a point where ecosystems will collapse and you lose many species. The speed of light, just not... there we go. So, The world is getting warmer. The temperature, even averaged over the whole planet, it fluctuates from year to year. But you can see over the last 30 or 40 years, the planet has been getting steadily warmer, especially if you average over 5 years to take out the El Nino variability, or average over 11 years to take out the solar cycle. Each decade has been warmer than the one before it. And that's going to be true next decade also. The reason we know that, we can prove that, is we now have the ability to measure the heat content of the ocean. The the planet is out of energy balance because of the greenhouse gases we're adding to the atmosphere, especially carbon dioxide, which absorbs infrared, that's heat radiation. So it's like a blanket. It reduces the heat radiation to space, and therefore it makes an imbalance between the amount of energy coming in from the sun and the amount radiated to space. And where does that excess energy go? Well, most of it has to go into the ocean because the atmosphere has a very small heat capacity and the continents have a low conductivity, so the thermal waves only penetrate a few tens of meters. But the ocean can take up heat to great depths because the ocean mixes. But beginning about 10 years ago, different nations of the world distributed more than 3,000 Argo floats around the world's ocean. These floats dive down into the ocean to a depth of 2 kilometers, making measurements, including the temperature, and then go back to the surface and radio the information to a satellite. And that allows us to measure the heat content of the ocean. And what we find is that the ocean is gaining heat at a rate of about 3/4 of a watt per meter squared. That tells us that there's about as much global warming in the pipeline that's going to occur in coming decades as the warming that has already occurred. And, of course, that's what we expect because of the inertia of the system and because of the fact that greenhouse gases have been continuing to increase. But there are other factors that affect global temperature. There are natural climate forcings as well as human-made ones. And it's often said by the people who don't want to believe that humans are the main factor now that the sun is really the main cause of climate change. Well, these measurements, and the sun does vary. The amount of energy coming from the sun varies with this magnetic cycle of about 11 years. But those measurements of the energy imbalance were made during solar minimum, the deepest solar minimum during the period of accurate satellite measurements. And despite the sun being dimmer than it is on average, there was more energy coming in than there was going out. So it proves that the... And we actually know the variation in that energy. It's about 1/4 of a watt, which is substantially smaller than the climate forcing due to carbon dioxide, which is about 1.7 watts. So humans are now the dominant factor forcing climate change. There we go. This is a temperature record of the Earth over the last 65 million years on the top curve. And then I've magnified the scale of the last 5 million years in the second curve. I've expanded it so you can see the oscillations, the glacial to interglacial oscillations. And then the last 800,000 years, I've expanded on the bottom. So you can see we now live in the Holocene, which is now more than 10,000 years long. The temperature has been relatively stable, and sea level has been stable during that period. The overall temperature change over the 65 million years is because of a change in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Naturally, it varies because the natural source of carbon dioxide is volcanoes associated with a continental drift. As the continents move, the mountain building at the edge of the continent has volcanoes which put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And this was a particularly active time because India was moving through the Indian Ocean and it collided with Asia 50 million years ago, and since then the volcanic activity has diminished and the planet has cooled off. And these oscillations, the glacial to interglacial oscillations, are associated with changes in the distribution of sunlight over the planet due to the perturbations of the Earth's orbit caused by Jupiter and Saturn and Venus mainly. But again, the mechanism that causes this oscillation is to a substantial degree due to changes in carbon dioxide. But now those natural changes of carbon dioxide are completely overwhelmed by the human-made increase in CO2 due to fossil fuel burning. Now, these oscillations, one consequence of the changing global temperature is a changing sea level. As the planet gets warmer, ice melts, and as it gets colder, ice sheets will grow. 20,000 years ago, when it was about 4 degrees cooler, the ice sheets on Canada, North America, and Eurasia caused sea level to be about 120 meters. That's about 400 feet lower. During the last interglacial period, which was warmer than the Holocene by about almost 2 degrees, sea level was about 6 meters higher. If you go back to the early Pliocene, when it was about 3 degrees warmer, sea level was about 15 to 25 meters higher. And if you go back more than 35 million years, the planet was warm enough that there was no ice sheets on the planet, and sea level was about 75 meters higher. It's about 250 feet higher. Well, now, because the planet is getting warmer, as I showed on my first chart, the sea level is beginning to rise. Much of this increase over the last century was due to the ocean getting warmer and the water expands a bit as it gets warmer. But now the ice is beginning to melt and sea level is beginning to rise more rapidly. Ice is melting, especially the Arctic Ocean. This sea ice does not cause sea level to rise when it melts, but And it is melting quite rapidly. This is the amount of sea ice that's left at the end of the melt season in September. And in this last September, the area covered by sea ice was only 51% of what averaged 3 decades ago. And the ice that remained was only about half as thick. So 3/4 of the volume of the ice has been lost. And the warming, that loss of sea ice and the warming ocean around Greenland allows Greenland to begin to lose mass. The area on Greenland that has melting varies from year to year depending on the weather, but in general it has been increasing. And that increased melt is causing the Greenland ice sheet to lose mass. We can now measure the mass of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets very precisely with the gravity satellite, which measures the gravitational field so accurately that you can see the changes in the mass. During the winter, the ice sheet gets heavier, and then during the melting season, it loses mass. But overall, it's losing mass at an increasing rate, and the same is true in Antarctica. Now, the question is how fast, if we allow the planet to become 2 degrees warmer, we can expect sea level to go up something of the order of 6 meters. We can't say how long it will take to get sea level rise of meters. The most recent IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, is estimating that it may be, or the recent papers that have been published are estimating that it may be of the order of a meter this century. I think it's more likely to be several meters because I think these curves are going to continue to go down more and more sharply. Right now, the rate of sea level rise is 3.1 millimeters a year, which is per century is a little more than a foot. but the rate is increasing quite rapidly. And it's very difficult to predict when an ice sheet will collapse because it's a nonlinear process. But the Earth's history tells us that, we should expect sea level rise of many meters. And if we continue with business as usual, we will get global warming of several degrees. And the last time the planet was several degrees warmer, sea level was at least 15 meters higher. So that means we will lose on some time scale. We are going to lose all of the cities and coasts around the world if we allow global temperature to go up a few degrees Celsius. What I'm starting out to tell you about are things that I think are important, but they don't get much traction with most of the public because you're talking about something which, well, IPCC talks about 2100, which is 87 years from now, and people just aren't very concerned about what sea level is going to be like 87 years from now. I think it could be by the middle of the century that we will have significant sea level rise, but it's hard to prove that. Another thing that I think is important, and again, it's something which doesn't get a lot of traction with most people, and that's the impact that climate change will have on other species on the planet. We, humans, are putting stresses on different species in different ways as we sort of take over the planet. But on the long run, the biggest problem will be from climate change as the climate zones shift. And I like to show this particular species. This is an insect, a monarch butterfly. In particular, this is a female whose wing has been broken. You can sort of see one of the wires, one of the hanging out the side of it. I began a few years ago with my grandchildren to plant milkweeds for monarch butterflies because monarchs, we noticed on our farm that we used to be able to see 5 or 10 monarchs at a time. Now we seldom see more than one at a time and sometimes none. So the number is decreasing. The reason that they're decreasing is because the milkweeds, the Roundup, the pesticide that's used by farmers to kill weeds, is killing the milkweed, and that's the only thing that the larva, the caterpillars of the monarch butterfly, can eat. But anyway, this particular butterfly, I could identify because I saw that broken wing, and it was for 3 weeks. She was the only butterfly in our yard, but she produced about 25 caterpillars, and at least most of them turned into butterflies. This was in 2011. But that was the year with the huge drought in Texas and Oklahoma. And so we wondered how many of these, and these butterflies migrate. They're a remarkable insect. They migrate all the way from Canada to a mountain in Mexico, where they hibernate. They all go on a small number of trees, and there are just millions of them on a given tree. But they have to travel through Texas to get there, and so we wondered how many would get there. And it turned out that year that there were about a 30% reduction in the number of monarchs making it to this Mexico mountain. And I wrote a story about that butterfly, and I got a letter then from a scientist in Mexico who was, his work was trying to understand the situation with the monarch butterflies, and what he said was that there's a problem because of the climate change in the region of this mountain, these mountains, where it's been getting warmer and having drought. And so the trees that the monarchs hibernate on are stressed, and many of them are in serious trouble. So he's trying to convince the government to plant trees higher up the mountain where the climate will be more appropriate. But he calculates that by late in the century, it will be too warm there, and so he has to find a higher mountain. And then you're going to have to train the monarchs to go to a different area. So, you know, actually there are efforts to train whooping cranes to go to a different area, because there's so few of them left, they're all going to the same place in Texas, and that's a little dangerous to have just one wintering place. So maybe with an iconic species like these, you can help them survive. But if we allow climate to change enough that the climate zones shift so much that the species have to migrate, that is going to cause a huge problem. And the IPCC report estimates that by the end of this century, we will have committed between 20 and 50% of the species to extinction if we allow business as usual and global warming to continue at the rate that it is. Now, again, that may not get a lot of traction with the public. But so now let me talk about something that does get more traction, and that's the increase in extreme events. This histogram on the left shows the normal distribution. It's a bell curve that describes the variability of summer average temperature. It fluctuates from one year to another by a couple of degrees, and here it's measured in standard deviations, so that this is the climate of last century, for a base period 1951 to 1980. But what's happening with global warming is that the chance of a season being warmer than average is increasing as the planet gets warmer. These are the last three decades. And in the most recent decade, you can see that what used to be a three standard deviation anomaly is something that occurred just a few tenths of 1% of a time. That's an extremely warm summer. Well, now that same anomaly is occurring about 10% of the time, or in other words, about 10% of the land area in a given summer has got an average summer temperature that occurred only a few tenths of a percent of the time 50 years ago. And that has consequences. One of the consequences is the more and hotter wildfires. And also, the places where it is the hottest tend to be where you have a high pressure. It will vary from one summer to another. The places that are warmer than normal will vary from one place to another, but those where it is hottest tend to have high atmospheric pressure and clear skies, and this increased temperature causes more evaporation and makes the droughts more extreme. This was in 2011, and then 2012 we again had three standard deviation anomaly in the Central Plains. The year before, in 2010, in the Moscow region and all the way down to the Middle East, there was a three standard deviation anomaly. The other end of the hydrologic cycle also is magnified by global warming, because the evaporation from water bodies, from the ocean, from lakes, is increased by the higher temperature, and that water vapor provides the energy for storms that are driven by latent heat. That means thunderstorms, tornadoes, and tropical storms. And also, because the warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, that means when you do get rainfall, the times and places that you do, you could get heavier rainfall and more extreme floods. Well, this is the hurricane that occurred, Hurricane Sandy, which, because the waters along the eastern coast of the United States were unusually warm, even though it was very late in the hurricane season, it was still warm enough for that storm to remain a hurricane all the way up to New York City, and there it got embedded in a frontal storm and swept onto the northeast, and all the way over to Lake Erie, where it still had tremendous power, and caused a lot of damage from trees being knocked down. From the floods, from the loss of power and the fires that resulted from that, and it even got some attention from the policymakers. Although probably not as much as it should have. At least Mayor Bloomberg in New York City drew it to their attention. Now, the problem is this. So far, we have burned the purple portion of the conventional oil, gas, and coal. There's a tremendous amount of coal that remains in the ground. And then there are these unconventional oil. This is tar sands, tar shale, and fracking to get oil, fracking to get gas. That what's clear is we have already burned almost as much and put as much CO2 into the atmosphere as we can afford to if we're going to avoid really disastrous climate change. We cannot burn all of this fossil fuels. If we burned all of this, we would go back to the ice-free state, and sea level would be 250 feet higher. It's the science, and there's no doubt about this in the science. You know, people can argue about how long it would take the ice sheets to melt, but if you burned all this fossil fuel, you will certainly cause all the ice to melt eventually. So, but what's happening? Even though it's clear we can't do that, what's happening is we have governments allowing and even encouraging the fossil fuel industry to go after everything they can find, whether it's tar sands, mountaintop removal, whatever they can find. And the CO2 emissions are actually accelerating. Particularly from coal. So the problem is that fossil fuels are the cheapest energy. And as long as they're the cheapest energy, then people are going to keep going after them and burning them. But they're only cheapest, partly because they're subsidized, but mainly because they don't have to pay their costs to society. The human health costs associated with air pollution and water pollution, asthma and any other things that you get from pollution, you have to pay out of your own pocket. The fossil fuel industry doesn't pay for that. And the climate effects are paid by you. They're paid by the taxpayer. Even the recent things, the droughts in the Midwest, the farmers get relief from the taxpayer. And it's going to be much more in the future. as the climate change gets larger. So what's needed is to put a rising price on carbon to make it pay, to make the fossil fuels pay their true costs. There we go. So what I suggest is that we should collect a fee from the fossil fuel companies at the domestic mine or the port of entry, which would cover all oil, gas, and coal, and the money that's collected should be distributed to the public on a per capita basis to all legal residents of the country. If that were done, then the public would have the resources to deal with the increased prices, because the price of fossil fuel, energy derived from fossil fuels, would go up, and people would need to begin to find ways to reduce their carbon footprint. And this would stimulate entrepreneurs, business people, to develop low carbon energy and energy efficiency. And this is a conservative approach which is market-based, and it does not enlarge the government, and it leaves the decisions to individuals. But we are now at what I call a fork in the road, because it's clear that we're beginning to run out of the conventional oil and gas. And so that's, and the choice is either we move toward clean energies, or we go after the dirtiest fossil fuels, the tar sands, fracking to get gas, and tar shale, mountaintop removal, and longwall mining of coal. We could readily move toward a clean energy future, but it requires honest pricing on fossil fuels. So what can you do about it? Well, you can write a letter to the president. My oldest grandchild, Sophie, is doing that, but then you have to get them to read it. Basically, what we're doing is telling the next generation that they're on their own. We're going to get whatever we can out of whatever we can dig out of the ground, and then the problem is going to be left for the next generation. This is my grandson, Jake. And then he's 2.5 years old in the one photo with his 2.5-day-old baby sister, who he thinks he can protect. But Jake actually has a severe peanut allergy, so we've got to kind of watch out after him. It's a case of intergenerational injustice. And our parents didn't know that they were causing a problem by burning fossil fuels, but we can only pretend that we don't know. And a lot of us are doing a good job at that. So, and that is foreign to the way that parents have been, the way that our forefathers thought. It's really a matter simply of governments with fossil fuel interests saying that they can set emissions at whatever level they choose. So one of the things we can do, is, which I'm getting more involved in, is trying to bring legal action to try to force the government to do its job and protect the rights of young people. Courts tend to be slow, however, and we don't have a whole lot of time. Another thing we can do, if I can get this to move. Very recalcitrant. Citizens Climate Lobby is an organization that's trying to educate the public by means of op-ed articles and educate and talk with lawmakers and try to encourage them to understand that we need to put a price on carbon, and the money should not be given back to the fossil fuel industry. It should be given to the public. And that organization has been growing rapidly, and I think maybe it's one of our best chances to begin to influence the democratic system. In fact, there is a bill in Congress now which at least partially is along the lines that we've been suggesting. I guess that must have been my last slide. So thanks very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, that was quite some presentation, very humbling. And I think the speed with which you spoke and just the breadth that you cover was really remarkable. And the slowness with which you spoke was really remarkable. So a lot to think about.
Well, it would have been faster if this thing would have worked.
If it had worked. No, I think the slow actually did kind of work for us. So anyway, I thought I'll kind of begin with, and I was kind of thinking some of the questions as you were speaking, beginning with something it seems that both you and I care about very deeply. That's why it was very moving for you to talk about that which does not get attention in the public discourse at all, and in government, of course. It's practically a vacuum, which is the non-human communities that we are wiping out at such a rapid rate. So I'll just share with you an example that is local here, because, you know, Santa Fe was my home for 4 years and New Mexico 11 years, that something that is remarkably intense has happened. The pinon trees, which is the state tree of New Mexico, between 2001 and 2005, 55 million pinons, 90% of all mature pinons died from bark beetle infestation. Mm-hmm. And later, the world sort of scientific community who are looking at the trees, one of the lead authors is from here, Craig Allen, mm-hmm. They came together to publish the first scientific article on forest deaths from climate change. So the pinion thing disappearing right in front of our eyes, and along with it, things like the pinion jay, that has this remarkable mechanism with which they store seeds and all of that just vanished right now. Who knows? We still have 10% left, how it would come back. So that's one thing, but I wanted to also just share with you a couple of news that are local, which is Bill DeBose, who is a local author, renowned author. He wrote a beautiful book called A Great Aridness that Oxford published couple of years ago, and many local organizations are doing amazing things with regard to climate change. They are here. Is one news I was just shared, so I share with the audience also, and with you, is New Energy Economy, and they have been fighting coal in New Mexico, because coal is a big thing that you have brought up again and again and again. They have been fighting, and last Friday they have very good news. This has been going on for a long time. They have gotten a lot of coverage in the New York Times and Washington Post. I serve on their advisory board. Is last Friday, New Energy Economy and several local environmental groups reached an agreement with PNM, the utility company, to close down two of the four units, 900 megawatts, at the San Juan Generating Station, one of the oldest and the dirtiest coal plants in the country. So that's happened. So with that, that's just more of a news and observation about something local I thought I'll share with you. Is let's talk about tar sands, because that's where a lot of the focus is, and then I want to go into a few other areas to hear your thoughts. Is you brought it up again and again that if we develop the tar sands, game over. And sure enough, Bill McKibben took it on, and the campaign began. Can you tell us a little bit, like, and because some of the critiques I have seen recently is saying, well, on its own, tar sands is not a carbon bomb. But you have again and again said that tar sands, if we develop that, it's game over. So can you tell us what exactly you
mean? The total amount of carbon in the tar sands is significantly less than the total amount of carbon in coal, for example. So it's true that by itself that what the game over is if we decide to go down the unconventional fossil fuel route. That's the first step down that path, and it's an incredibly stupid step because it's so carbon intensive and also regionally polluting, destroying so much of that region in Canada. It simply doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any economic sense if you just made fossil fuels pay a fraction of their true cost. You just add, we've done modeling adding $10 a ton each year for 10 years. By the time you get to the end of 10 years, in the United States, that would reduce emissions 30%, which is more than 10 times the amount of carbon in the Keystone XL pipeline. So if way before you got to this $100 a ton after 10 years, the tar sands would make no sense at all. And that's what they know. That's why they want so eager to get that pipeline built, because once it's built, it's going to be used.
Then they'll be using it.
Yeah.
Right.
But it makes no sense. And, you know, to go back to what you said earlier about the impact that we're having on different species and things, that's going to continue and get much more extreme if we continue to burn more and more fossil fuels. But the truth is, what has become clear is that we're actually going to have to take CO2 down to a level somewhat less than what it is now. If in order for the ice sheets to be stable, we're going to have to restore the planet's energy balance. And that means that winters are going to have to be cold, you know. And the good news is, you know, that is possible if we would begin to phase down emissions at a rate of the order of 5% a year. Now, that's actually possible. You know, the people who just say, oh, no, business as usual has to continue. Well, that's just because that's what fossil fuel industry wants. You know, and if you don't think that an alternative is possible, then what are you saying? The world is going to come to an end in a couple hundred years when the fossil fuels run out? Obviously, that's not true. We can move to different energies, and we have to do that sooner rather than waiting until we've destroyed everything.
Well, that's exactly the situation. But looking at U.S. right now, the reality, and something it seems like in the last 2-3 years has happened, is this whole rhetoric that our dependence on foreign oil has now transferred into that we are going to make everything domestic production, domestic consumption. Which is a fallacy, because the amount U.S. consumes, we can never really supply with all domestic. But even if we did, it's Devastating.
That's not even true. In fact, we're planning to export our coal to China.
That's right.
We're planning to have the tar sands pipeline make oil, which will be exported.
Which will be exported out. So basically, they're lying.
Yeah.
Basically, they're lying to us. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. And looking at it, if we see
the reason that can happen is there is a very small percentage of the people who will make a lot of money.
Right.
And they control... You can't turn on your television without seeing these advertisements about clean coal and clean tar sands. And the fact that there are lots of jobs associated with that, which is false. There are more jobs associated with the changes that would be needed. If we had a rising price on carbon, it would force a lot of changes. It would drive industry and then we could be a world leader in developing the clean energies. But instead, what they're wanting us to do is to stick with these old fossil fuels, which it simply doesn't make any sense. But as long as they're able to control the media and government.
Right.
We have, as I always say, well-oiled, coal-fired governments. And I thought that was just the United States, but in going to a dozen other countries, it is true almost everywhere.
And the well-oiled, coal-fired government, like if we look at some of the projects that's taking place right now, they're sitting us on a 100-year path of fossil fuel energy. Like now the Arctic Ocean has opened up. Shale's oil drilling that President Obama approved. Last year it started. The entire Gulf of Mexico is completely open now, right? That the depth that they're going to go, 5,000 feet, is actually nothing. That up to 15,000 feet, that there are some leases that are going down. And now the tar sands coming.
Again, those places are actually hard to get at. It's really impressive equipment they're using. It's very expensive to do that. So all we need is that rising price on carbon, and they will be cut out of the market. I mean, we will move to clean energies. But unless we get that price, we're just going to keep doing this. We're going to keep burning more and more fossil fuels.
So in a way, like the citizens' lobby, climate lobby, you mentioned that we really have to get the public engaged force the government, because there doesn't seem to be any other root insight to change course.
And it's hard to do, especially, the fee that's collected from fossil fuel companies is equivalent to a tax. Nobody wants to see a tax. But if that money is given to the public, 100% per capita, then about 60% of the people would get more in their monthly dividend than they would pay through increased energy prices. So, and it has to be very simple. The public is not going to trust the government. If that's why this cap and trade system, the public knew, that in fact it was hokey. It was giving away money to utilities and coal companies and everything. It brought big banks into the problem. Trading would happen, and they would make lots of money. Right. And where does that money come from? It doesn't come out of thin air. It comes out of the public's pocket. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you want a very simple system. And that is possible, but the only people who gain from that are the public. And they're not the ones who control Washington. That's the problem. In a democracy, they're supposed to. But that's not the way it works. The lobbyists we have... We're never able to get campaign finance reform. So, in fact, our government is heavily involved with lobbying. The example I give was Richard Gephardt, mm-hmm. a Democrat who was the leader in the House. When he failed to get a nomination to run for the president, he retired. And the first year, just from one source, Peabody Coal, he got $120,000 per quarter. That's almost $500,000 a year to lobby in Washington. That's the way our government now works. when if they're elected to Washington, then they feel they have the right to be rich, and that means that they will become lobbyists.
Gail Norton left after she had to resign. She went and joined Shell, Secretary of Interior.
And this is happening again and again. Democracy should not be allowing this, but to fix that is going to take time. So that's why I think the quickest thing we can do is get the public to understand that we need to have this price on carbon, and the money has to go back to the public.
And you have been promoting that. So let me switch gear a little bit and talk about a little bit of the international scene. I just came back from India last month after being there 3 months. And here you have fought for a long time from the beginning with this idea of the climate skeptics or the climate denier being funded by the merchants of doubt, which is, I think, what Eric Conway and Naomi Oreskes called them, merchants of doubt. In India, what I see is happening is, which is basically a product that came out of here, merchants of desire. So India is now poised to become the third largest or the second largest auto manufacturer in the world within the next few years. All of the car companies are out there, and Tata, which is India's largest, one of the largest companies in the world, introduced this tiny little car called Nano a few years ago as a green car. Anybody can buy this, $2,000, and it's a green car, less emission. Of course, give a billion people a car. And that got coverage in the front page of the Newsweek of Time magazine or something. Now, the same company, now they have, of course, rolled that out onto the market, every day, day after day, putting full-page ad on SUV. So now Tata's ad is about these large SUVs taming the beast. That's the title of the ad. So while we are dealing with this increased production, continuing to increase production, over there, we are dealing with these merchants of desires are pushing the consumption side in a big way. So we have a lot of work on our hand. Like, how do we deal with all this?
Yeah, well, vehicles do produce about a third of the carbon dioxide. So we're going to have vehicles that do not run on fossil fuels. And that's possible. And again, the only way it's going to happen is with the rising price on carbon. It all comes back to the same thing. The world's problems are large. And speaking of India, the population is of the world is part of the problem. But actually, if you look at the developed countries, the birth rates are now, in most of them, are actually below the replenishment level.
Right.
So it's something that there's some hope that we can get to the point beyond the maximum population and leave space on the planet for the other species. But it will require that we use clean energies.
Mm-hmm.
And,
can you talk about China with regard to the clean energy, their investment?
Yeah, China is probably our best hope.
Mm-hmm.
Because, first of all, they don't deny the science. So they realize that humans are changing the climate, and they're changing the atmosphere in their country with the air pollution there, tremendous air pollution. So they plan by the middle of the century to have clean energies, including for their electrical power demands are huge. Mm-hmm. And so they're building more than 30 nuclear power plants. And they're the number one in solar and the number one in wind energy. And by the way, in just the last 2 days, there's been an announcement that they're going to have a carbon tax.
Oh, they will?
Yes.
So the idea we have been talking about is slowly coming. Somebody is picking it up.
I think they do understand that they have to, that's one way to control the excess of pollution. And on the long run, you have to phase that out. They have 350 million people living near sea level. They can't allow the ice sheets to go unstable. And they don't deny that science. So they are thinking about the problem, but they've also got an awfully lot of poor people mm-hmm. that they're trying to raise out of mm-hmm. poverty. So they've got a tough problem, but at least they're trying to address it.
So let me switch gear a little bit and ask you a couple of questions with regard to the Arctic. And in your book, and again, the science part is not clear to me. It will be nice for us to hear because I see it as a potential serious problem, is the methane issue in the Arctic. Now, let me just go back. In your book, you talk about the end Permian extinction, that 250 million years ago, that wiped out 90% of the species, 10% magically survived, from which biodiversity returned after millions of years. And the root cause was the massive Arctic methane release. And then you talk about that after millions of years, the Arctic methane gun is fully loaded again. Your words, not mine. You mentioned that. And with the time that I have been spending, especially in the last 5-6 years, the permafrost melt is very visible. All these old coffins are coming up, and it's very intense. And National Science Foundation studies some of the things that they're doing in the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, that some of the subsea methane is releasing as well. Can you talk about the Arctic methane today and where things are and how is that moving forward besides the melting of the ice cap?
Yeah. What he's referring to is the methane molecules that are frozen in water, water cage, in effect, and there's a lot of that methane on the continental shelves and in the tundra. And there's also carbon in that tundra, which in the form of peat, which if you melt the tundra, you'll get CO2 coming out of that, as well as the methane being released. So far, and it is, we are beginning to melt tundra, and there are measurements that some methane is beginning to percolate out. So far, it's not very much. That's part of this fork in the road. We either, if we continue, and that's why 2 degree Celsius global warming target does not make any sense. Because if we, those 2 degree targets are associated with estimates of how much CO2 you would need to get to 2 degrees global warming. But if you get 2 degrees global warming, then you are going to melt tundra. You are going to get additional warming from that.
So even at 2 degrees, you would melt the tundra?
Well, you can see that at point, which right now is less than 1 degree warming. We already see that it's starting. So the truth is we need to get, that's why one of the reasons why the target needs to be that which would restore the planet's energy balance, and that's 350 parts per million. That's where the 350 ppm came from. If we do that, then it actually cools down somewhat. And that's why I say winters need to be cold, mm-hmm. and the Arctic needs to be cold. Mm-hmm. With the 2 degrees, we would lose all the sea ice in the Arctic. There's no way that the Greenland ice sheet could be stable if we lose the Arctic sea ice. So we can't go that path. That's the one path. But the fork in the road is we've got to go this way. We've got to not get into the unconventional fossil fuels, and we have to phase out the coal.
Coal.
And that would happen naturally. You can't, you know, we can protest against tar sands, or we can protest against mountaintop removal, and you may even get a politician to try to stop that particular thing. But those things on the long run will not be effective.
That's right, because
if you don't have the carbon price, because eventually somebody else will dig
up the coal.
Some
other projects will percolate up.
Yeah.
Right.
So it all comes back to forcing fossil fuels to pay their cost to society. And the public just doesn't have the clout that the fossil fuel industry has. That's the problem. And strangely enough, we're saying this in a democracy where the public is supposed, the government is supposed to serve the public. And yet I'm
telling... But do we really live in a democracy?
And even that I'm telling, and yet I'm telling you that China is our best hope.
Is it?
Because, exactly. Because China's run by engineers and they see what's happening.
Right. And they're really investing.
Yeah, but yeah. Still we have to try to make our democracy work. And writing a letter to the president isn't enough. We've got to do more.
We've got to get engaged. We've got to get out on the streets. And here in New Mexico, we have great activist community. We have a really fantastic activist community out here. So I guess I had promised. So why don't you tell that story of the 350? Because I promised that you'll mention, hopefully, that how that the 350.org came about. That well, like story it, because it was 450,
yeah,
and then yeah.
Well, Bill called me and said he was about to form an organization called 450.org. And I said, wait a minute, because I'm working on this paper, and I'm sure it's not 450. And so he kept, every month, he kept asking me. And finally I said, well, at the AGU meeting, I will give a number. I'm getting close enough.
Because Copenhagen was coming up.
But that was before we had these measurements of the planet's energy imbalance. Mm-hmm. It was based on a number of different factors, which led us to believe that about 350 was probably about right. But then when we got these measurements of the energy imbalance, it's 3/4 of a watt. That's exactly, and we're now at 395 parts per million. Well, we can calculate the radiation with an accuracy of a few percent. That tells us that we would have to reduce by about 50 ppm, so back to about 350. So that's what we need to do. And it's still possible because the ocean, the CO2 that we put in the atmosphere is not yet in equilibrium with the ocean. So some of it will get taken up by the ocean. If we also reforest some of the places we've deforested, and if we improve agricultural practices so that the soil retains more carbon, then we could get back to 350 ppm this century. But that requires that we not burn all these other
dirty stuff.
Then it would become impossible.
Thank you very much. We have come to the end of our time.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.